Yeah. So yes, the last time we read the Modes of the Self, chapter 11, page 374 in the new edition. Should we jump over to chapter 12, the realization of Satchitananda? Or
I think we read the Modes of the Self again.
Because John Robert was not present, so we can reread it again, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I start, and me and Andrea reading now. Chapter 11, with a little meditation.
Yeah. Do you have your bell, John Robert?
Let me find it. I have a lot of really loud there's a really loud lawnmower outside my door. Can you hear it? You're
It sounded like somebody was chanting. Oh,
it sounds like a cow mooing.
The lawnmower is right outside my window, so I'll ring the bell and I'll turn it off so you can hear it.
Chapter 11, part 2 of the synthesis of yoga, the modes of the self. Since the self, which we come to realize by the path of knowledge, is not only the reality which lies behind and supports the states and movements of our psychological being, but also that transcends the transcendent and universal existence which has manifested itself in all the movements of the universal, the knowledge of the self includes also the knowledge of the principle of being, its fundamental modes, and its relations with the principles of the phenomenal universe. This was what was meant by the Upanishad when it spoke of the Brahman and that which being known, all is known. In a footnote, there is a Sanskrit version. Yashmin vijnate shurvanam vijnatavam. It has to be realized first as a pure principle of existence. Afterwards, says the Upanishad, its essential modes become clear to the soul which realizes it. We may indeed, before realization, try to analyze by the metaphysical reason and even understand intellectually what being is and what the world is, but such metaphysical understanding is not the knowledge. Knowledge with capital K. Moreover, we may have the realization and knowledge and vision, but this is incomplete without realization in the entire soul experience and the unity of all our being with that which we realize. Again, there is a footnote. This is a distinction made in the Gita between Sankhya and Yoga. Both are necessary to an integral knowledge. It is the science of yoga to know and the art of yoga to be unified with the highest so that we may live in the self and act from that supreme poise, becoming one not only in the conscious essence but in the conscious law of our being with the transcendent divine whom all things and creatures, whether ignorantly or with partial knowledge and experience, seek to express through the lower law of their members. To know the highest truths and to be in harmony with its condition of right being, to express it in all that we are, experience, and do, is a condition of right living.
But rightly to know and express the highest is not easy for man, the mental being, because the highest truth and therefore the highest modes of existence are supramental. They repose on the essential unity of what seem to the intellect and mind and are to our mental experience of the world opposite poles of existence and idea, and therefore irreconcilable opposites and contradictions. But to the supramental experience are complementary aspects of the same truth. We have seen this already in the necessity of realizing the self as at once one and many, for we have to realize each thing and being as that. We have to realize the unity of all as that, both in the unity of some and in the oneness of essence. And we have to realize that as the transcendent who is beyond all this unity, and this multiplicity, which we see everywhere as the two opposite, yet companion poles of all existence. For every individual being is the self, the divine, in spite of the outward limitations of the mental and physical form through which it presents itself at the actual moment, in the actual field of space, in the actual succession of circumstances that make up the web of inner state and outward action and event through which we know the individual. So equally, every collectivity, small or great, is each the self, the divine similarly expressing itself in the conditions of this manifestation. We cannot really know any individual or any collectivity if we know it only as it appears inwardly to itself, or outwardly to us, but only if we know it as the divine, the one, our own self employing its various essential modes and its occasional circumstances of self-manifestation. Until we have transformed the habits of our mentality so that it shall live entirely in this knowledge, reconciling all differences in the one, we do not live in the real truth. Because we do not live in the real unity. The accomplished sense of unity is not that in which all are regarded as parts of one whole, waves of one sea, but that in which each, as well as the all, is regarded wholly as a divine, wholly as ourself in a supreme identity.
And yet, so complex is the Maya of the infinite. There is a sense in which the view of all as parts of the whole, waves of the sea, or even as in a sense separate entities, become a necessary part of the integral truth and the integral knowledge. Integral truth and the integral knowledge. For if the self is always one in all, yet we see that for the purposes at least of the cyclic manifestation, it expresses itself in perpetual soul forms, which preside over the movements of our personality through the worlds and the eons. This persistent soul existence is the real individuality, which stands behind the constant mutations of the thing we call our personality. It is not a limited ego, but a thing in itself infinite. It is, in truth, the infinite itself, consenting from one plane of its being to reflect itself in a perpetual soul experience. This is the truth which underlies the Sankhya theory of many Purushas, many essential, infinite, free, and impersonal souls reflecting the movements of a single cosmic energy. It stands also in a different way behind the very different philosophy of qualified monism, which arose as a protest against the metaphysical excess of Buddhistic nihilism and illusionist Advaita. The old semi-Buddhistic, semi-Sankhya theory, which saw only the quiescent and nothing else in the world except a constant combination of the five elements and the three modes of inconscient energy, lighting up their false activity by the consciousness of the quiescent in which it is reflected, is not the whole truth of the Brahman. We are not a mere mass of changing mind stuff, life stuff, body stuff, taking different forms of mind and life and body from birth to birth, so that at no time is there any real self or conscious reason of existence behind all the flux, or none except that quiescent who cares for none of these things. There is a real and stable power of our being behind the constant mutation of our mental, vital, and physical personality. And this we have to know and preserve in order that the infinite may manifest himself through it according to his will in whatever range and for whatever purpose of his eternal cosmic activity.
Would you like to try and read a little bit, John Robert?
I can try and see how this goes. This is some beautiful writing, isn't it? It's really something. And if we regard existence from the standpoint of the possible eternal and infinite relations of this one, from whom all things proceed, these many, of whom the one is the essence and the origin, in this energy, power, or nature, through which the relations of the one and the many are maintained, we shall see a certain justification, even for the dualist philosophies and religions, which seem to deny most energetically the unity of beings, and to make an unbridgeable differentiation between the Lord and his creatures. If in their grosser forms, these religions aim only at the ignorant joys of the lower heavens, yet there is a far higher and profounder sense in which we may appreciate the cry of the devotee poet, when in a homely and vigorous metaphor, he claimed the right of the soul to enjoy forever the ecstasy of its embrace of the Supreme. I do not want to become sugar, he wrote. I want to eat sugar. So I'll pass that on to somebody else.
However strongly we found ourselves on the essential identity of the one self in all, We need not regard that cry as the mere aspiration of a certain kind of spiritual sensuousness, or the rejection by an attached and ignorant soul of the pure and high austerity of the Supreme Truth. On the contrary, it aims in its positive part at a deep and mysterious truth of beings which no human language can utter, of which human reason can give no adequate account, to which the heart has the key, and which no pride of the soul of knowledge insisting on its own pure austerity can abolish. But that belongs properly to the summit of the path of devotion, and there we shall have again to return to it.
The sadhaka of an integral yoga will take an integral view of his goal and seek its integral realization. The divine has many essential modes of his eternal self-manifestation, possesses and finds himself on many planes and through many poles of his being. To each mode, its purpose, to each plane or pole, its fulfillment, both in the apex and the supreme scope of the eternal unity. It is necessary through the individual self that we must arrive at the One, for that is the basis of all our experience. By knowledge, we arrive at identity with the One, for there is, in spite of the dualist, an essential identity by which we can plunge into our source and free ourselves from all bondage to individuality and even from all bondage to universality. Nor is the experience of that identity a gain for knowledge only or for the pure state of abstract being. The height of all our action also, we have seen, is the immersion of ourselves in the Lord through unity with the divine will or consciousness power by the way of works. The height of love in the rapturous immersion of ourselves in unity, of ecstatic delight with the object of our love and adoration. But again, for divine works in the world, the individual self converts itself into a center of consciousness through which the divine will, one with the divine love and light, pours itself out in the multiplicity of the universe. We arrive in the same way at our unity with all our fellow beings through the identity of this self with the Supreme and with the self in all others. At the same time, the action of nature we preserve by its. At the same time, in the action of nature, we preserve by it as sole form of the One, a differentiation which enables us to preserve relations of differences in oneness with the other beings and with the Supreme Himself. I don't understand this sentence. I have to read it again. At the same time, in the action of nature, we preserve by it as sole form of the One, a differentiation which enables us to preserve relations of differences in oneness with other beings and with the Supreme Himself. Okay. The relations will necessarily be very different in essence and spirit from those which we had when we lived entirely in the ignorance and oneness. The relations will necessarily be very different in essence and spirit from those which we had when we lived entirely in the ignorance and oneness, was a mere name or a struggling aspiration of imperfect love, sympathy, and yearning. Unity will be the law. Difference will be simply for the variation, various. Unity will be the law. Difference will be simply for the various enjoyments of that unity. Neither descending again into that plane of division, which clings to the separation of the ego sense, nor attached to an exclusive seeking for pure identity, which cannot have to do with any play of difference. We shall embrace and reconcile the two poles of being where they meet in the infinity of the highest. Wow, I think this paragraph would merit a discussion in itself, sentence by sentence, an analysis by itself, sentence by sentence, because I think it's every sentence is a universe in itself.
It's loaded.
Because a lot of things come to my mind when I see this sentence. I see that, especially in the world happenings nowadays. But it can be seen immediately in an intuitive flash. But if I try to explain it and to translate it or to reframe it in words, it would need an encyclopedia. I mean, and it's incredible how he's able to compress this into a paragraph.
There's just no one like him.
I would love to have his, not just the realizations and the yoga, only the linguistic power that he has. Then perhaps I would sell some book more.
I think the linguistic ability and and goes with all the realizations, because he sees in so many different ways. Yeah. Seems like this paragraph is largely about the not just the oneness, as if that was a just. The oneness as if that was a just. So he says that's the real basis, but he says not just the oneness, but the difference also has to be enjoyed.
And it's interesting that he said there's a one only that, where he says the only reason of the difference is it's enjoyment or something like that. Where did I see this?
It's the enjoyment of the unity in the differences. Yeah.
But the only, where he says only, why only? Well, let me see. But this is only true. Where did I see that? You see, I read this, and then the intuitive understanding remains, but the exact phrasing, now I lost the page.
Why don't you read it again? Why don't you read that paragraph again?
Not me, perhaps, because I think it's better that it comes from different sources. Because
you want to try again, John Robert, or you want to?
Why don't you do it, Andrea?
Yeah. And yet, so complex is the Maya of the infinite. There is a sense in which the view of all as parts of the whole, waves of the sea, or even as in a sense separate entities, becomes
where
a
necessary.
Yeah.
I think no, I went back two pages.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Okay. The sadhaka, that's the right one, right? The sadhaka of the integral yoga will take an although I was really enjoying what I just read. I didn't remember a word of it. The sadhaka of an integral yoga will take an integral view of his goal and seek its integral realization. The divine has many essential modes of his eternal self-manifestation, possesses and finds himself on many planes and through many poles of his being. To each mode its purpose, to each plane or pole its fulfillment, both in the apex and the supreme scope of the eternal unity. It is necessarily through the individual self that we must arrive at the one, for that is the basis of all our experience. By knowledge, we arrive at identity with the one, for there is, in spite of the dualist, an essential identity by which we can plunge into our source and free ourselves from all bondage to individuality and even from all bondage to universality. Nor is the experience of that identity. Do you need me for a moment? Scott, do you need me?
It's right.
It's sitting out there.
What is?
On the table.
Sorry.
All right. Sorry. My friend is working on my hot tub. Okay, now where am I? I'll just go here. By knowledge, we arrive at identity with the one, for there is, in spite of the dualist, an essential identity by which we can plunge into our source and free ourselves from all bondage to individuality and even from all bondage to universality. Nor is the experience of that identity a gain for knowledge only or for the pure state of abstract being. The height of all our action also, we have seen, is the immersion of ourselves in the Lord through unity with the divine will or conscious power by the way of works. The height of love is the rapturous immersion of ourselves in unity of ecstatic delight with the object of our love and adoration. But again, for divine works in the world, the individual self converts itself into a center of consciousness through which the divine will, one with the divine love and light, pours itself out in the multiplicity of the universe. We arrive in the same way at our unity with all our fellow beings through the identity of this self with the Supreme and with the self in all others. At the same time, in the action of nature, we preserve by it as sole form of the one, a differentiation which enables us to preserve relations of difference in oneness with other beings and with the Supreme Himself. The relations will necessarily be very different in essence and spirit from those which we had when we lived entirely in the ignorance, and oneness was a mere name or a struggling aspiration of imperfect love, sympathy, or yearning. Unity will be the law. Difference will be simply for the various enjoyment of that unity. I think that's the sentence you were thinking of. Unity will be the law. Difference will be simply for the various enjoyment of that unity. Neither descending again into that plane of division, which clings to the separation of the ego sense, nor attached to an exclusive seeking of pure identity which cannot have to do with any play of difference, we shall embrace and reconcile the two poles of being where they meet in the infinity of the highest. Wow, that was great to read again.
Yeah, the sentence was, the difference will be not only, but simply. I don't know if it's the same significance, but difference will be simply for the various enjoyment of the unity. So the divine self-differentiated itself only to enjoy the differences. Wow, this is you can write tomes about that from a philosophical point of view.
Why bother to create a manifestation if you don't want to be in every single part of it?
Yeah. Right? At the end, you want to be in every single part of it, yes.
Yeah. And he is, of course, it is because it is all there is. In all the many various manifestations, right?
Yeah, I'm seeing this now from the perspective of the Western metaphysician who says, but this is a being that has self-differentiated itself to enjoy the things that apparently seem to be other than itself. And why should he do it? Why should it do it, or he, she, it do it? Why could it not remain in some ecstatic nirvana and enjoy itself in unity and peace? And what's the need to create us all this chaos and mess that we are nowadays? So you see, I am a lot in contact with this Western mind, or with this Western way of thinking. Unfortunately, also with the skeptical academia. And I already, every time when I read these things, I hear them resonate them in the background. And yeah, if this is a powerful solution to all, not to all, but to a lot of philosophical, metaphysical problems, but at the same time needs much more than that, yes. But I love this. Yes. So it's simply, so simple. Very simple.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck, yeah, really. Yeah, it's just simple for him. And what I also see here is peace building. How to construct peace among humans, where we have, now we have again, oh, this problem. They are again going to have, there's again a risk of war between Serbia and Kosovo. And if you study this, go to the origin of the real reasons, not what you heard from people, it is always because one side or the other does not recognize the other side's diversity and does not accept and allow for the expression of this diversity on its land, on its territory. And for example, then there is now the Serbian part in Kosovo that would like to create some municipalities inside Kosovo, not a separation, not a sort of federalist, something that goes into the direction of a federalist understanding of society, the state, and so on. And if you look what's that about, it's always the mind, the spirit, the vital, our personality, looking for an integration between differences. And he says here, it will not work if it's just only a sympathy. Where was this now? I have this. He was speaking of sympathy. The relations will necessarily be very different in essence and spirit from those which we had when we lived entirely in the ignorance and oneness. And oneness was a mere name or struggling aspiration or of imperfect love, sympathy, or yearning. You can see this in the building of the nation buildings, in the developments. Of course, Sri Aurobindo describes this much more in depth in the ideal of human unity and war and self-determination. So, but as I read it, at least, it's not sufficient that you find some political machinery where there's some agreement, a little bit of sympathy here, and but inwardly there is this wall of separation. It will sooner or later reemerge, and then we will have all the story from all the world again. No? And I think this is also, I see peace building here in these words here, because we are negating our inner nature. Yeah, as impossible as it might sound, all this divergence. Think of the Russians and the Ukrainians, complete hate. And yet it is the same divine in its differences that fights to each other. In this situation, these kind of things would not work, I think. But if we learn from childhood to see the others, not just as someone who we have to, well, to accept and somehow, okay, give them their rights, but please remain far away from me, or as the other with whom I cannot identify, but who is not interesting. For example, I don't identify not at all with the Indian Americans, but I find their culture, even their clothing, sometimes it's extremely fascinating, interesting. It's something immediately attracts my attention because I see the diversity, and I enjoy the diversity, which is something that seems, at least, having nothing to do with me because I have no relationship with Indian Americans. But precisely for this reason, I'm attracted to them. Okay, so I'm digressing. I'm sorry, but I could speak about these things for hours. And okay.
Why don't you read again?
What? This again? All this chapter again? No. No, no.
No, just start reading.
Yeah. Okay, so the next paragraph. The self, even the individual self, is different from our personality as it is different from our mental ego sense. Our personality is never the same. It is a constant mutation and various combination. It is not a basic consciousness, but a development of forms of consciousness, not a power of being, but a various play of partial powers of being. Not the enjoyer of the self-delight of our existence, but the seeking after various notes and tones of experience which shall more or less render that delight in the mutability of relations. This also is Purusha and Brahman, but it is a mutable Purusha, the phenomenon of the eternal, not its stable reality. The Gita makes a distinction between three Purushas who constitute the whole state and action of the divine being, the mutable, the immutable, and the highest, which is beyond and embraces the other two. The highest is the Lord in whom we have to live, the supreme self in us and in all. The mutable is the result, no, sorry, the immutable is the silent, actionless, equal, unchanging self, which we reach when we draw back from activity to passivity, from the play of consciousness and force and the seeking of delight to the pure and constant basis of consciousness and force and delight, through which the highest, free, secure, and unattached possesses and enjoys the play. The immutable is the substance and immediate motive that of that changing flux of personality through which the relations of our cosmic life are made possible. The mental being fixed in the mutable moves in its flux and has not possession of the eternal peace and power and self-delight. The soul fixed in the immutable holds all these in itself, but cannot act in the world. But the soul that can live in the highest enjoys the eternal peace and power and delight and wideness of being. Sorry, no, this was not the end of the sentence. I read this again. The Mental being fixed in the mutable moves in its flux and has not possession of an eternal peace and power and self-delight. The soul fixed in the immutable holds all these in itself, but cannot act in the world. But the soul that can live in the highest enjoys the eternal peace and power and delight and whiteness of being, is not bound in its self-knowledge and self-power by character and personality or by forms of its force and habits of its consciousness, and yet uses them all with a large freedom and power for the self-expression of the divine in the world. Here again, the change is not any alteration of the essential modes of the self, but consists in our emergence into the freedom of the highest and the right use of the divine law of our being.
Boy.
Yeah, here also.
Quite some sentences there.
Yeah. When he says, the mutable is the substance and immediate motive of that changing flux of personality through which the relations of our cosmic life are made possible.
Right, you cannot relate if you stay fixed, right? You have to move to relate. So that's the mutable. The mutable is necessary for the relationship with everything.
Yeah. It's all, yeah, now I see it, yeah. But it's almost self-obvious and evident. if nothing is mutable, there can be no relations whatsoever. Yeah, and that's why we have also these, also in the Christian tradition, we have something, I don't know where it is, or to little children, when you try to tell them why God created the universe and us humans, of course. And the answer is because God didn't want to remain alone. Yeah? God felt alone. Yeah, it is a bit for a parable, a metaphor for children, but it has its reality.
Yeah,
it has its fundamental truths here, as according to Sherbino, who says the divine multiplied itself to enjoy itself in the multiplicity. So you see that every parable, as childish as it might be, has its core of truths, and it helps. Yeah.
We are only children.
Yeah. I'm pretty convinced that in the year 3565, when I will be the Gnostic being and then reread this stuff and say, yeah, dear Sherbindo, what you were just the first primitive primate of the supramental race. Probably we will look at us more than ever, but perhaps also to him as the first human beings in the Stone Age, as we now are looking at it. Yeah? So I, even these texts, I don't take them as the ultimate truth, but it's further than that, on our mental level, we cannot get, and we cannot describe this. I think in the next generation, which is supramental, might come with something more. But on the mental level, I don't think that we can go further than that. No? So it has its.
And well, he is the one actually bringing this down into humanity's consciousness. It wasn't here before. So.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that nowadays, if he would review this stuff, I'm not sure that he would say, oh, yeah, it's all right. I think there would be also things that he will review. good review. But well, it's enough for now.
Yes.
We have more than enough to ponder on and to learn from.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Continue reading.
Could we finish this quickly, or what should we do? Yeah, let's finish.
1, 2, 3, 3, 4 mm-hmm. pages.
Let's make a tour de force, quickly finish it.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Connected with this triple mode of the self is that distinction which Indian philosophy has drawn between the qualitied and the qualityless Brahman, and European thought has made between the personal and the impersonal God. The Upanishad indicates clearly enough the relative nature of this opposition when it speaks of the Supreme as the qualitied who is without qualities. We have again two essential modes, two fundamental aspects, two poles of eternal being, both of them exceeded in the transcendent divine reality. They correspond practically to the silent and the active Brahman. For the whole action of the universe may be regarded from a certain point of view as the expression and shaping out in various ways of the numberless and infinite quality of the Brahman. His being assumes by conscious will all kinds of properties, shapings of the stuff of conscious being, habits, as it were, of cosmic character and power of dynamic self-consciousness, gunas, into which all the cosmic action can be resolved. But by none of these, nor by all of them, nor by their utmost infinite potentiality, is he bound. He is above all his qualities, and on a certain plane of being rests free from them. The nirguna, or unqualitied, is not incapable of qualities, rather it is this very nirguna, or no quality, who manifests himself as saguna, as anantaguna, infinite quality, since he contains all in his absolute capacity of boundlessly varied self-revelation. Boundlessly varied self-revelation. He is free from them in the sense of exceeding them. And indeed, if he were not free from them, they could not be infinite. God would be subject to his qualities, bound by his nature. Prakriti would be supreme, and Purusha is its creation and plaything. The eternal is bound neither by quality nor absence of quality, neither by personality nor by impersonality. He is himself beyond all our positive and all our negative definitions.
But if we cannot define the eternal, we can unify ourselves with it. It has been said that we can become the impersonal, but not the personal God. But this is only true in the sense that no one can become individually the Lord of all the universes. We can free ourselves into the existence of the active Brahman as well as that of the silence. We can live in both, go back to our being in both, but each in its proper way by becoming one with the nirguna in our essence and one with the saguna in the liberty of our active being in our nature. Sadharmya Mukti. The Supreme pours himself out of an eternal peace, poise and silence into an eternal activity free and infinite, freely fixing for itself its self-determinations, using infinite quality to shape out of it varied combination of quality. We have to go back to that peace, poise and silence and act out of it with the divine freedom from the bondage of qualities, but still using qualities, even the most opposite, largely and flexibly for the divine work in the world. Only while the Lord acts out of the center of all things, we have to act by transmission of his will and power and self-knowledge through the individual center, the soul form of him which we are. The Lord The Lord is subject to nothing. The individual soul form is subject to its own highest self, and the greater and more absolute is that subjection, the greater becomes its sense of absolute force and freedom.
The distinction between the personal and the impersonal is substantially the same as the Indian distinction, but the associations of the English words carry within them a certain limitation which is foreign to Indian thought. The personal God of the European religions is a person in the human sense of the word, limited by his qualities though otherwise possessed of omnipotence and omniscience. It answers to the Indian special conceptions of Shiva, or Vishnu, or Brahma, or of the Divine Mother of All, Durga, or Kali. Each religion really erects a different personal deity according to its own heart and thought to adore and serve. The fierce and inexorable God of Calvin is a different being from the sweet and loving God of Saint Francis, as the gracious Vishnu is different from the terrible, though always loving and beneficent Kali, who has pity even in her slaying and saves by her destructions. Shiva, the god of ascetic renunciation who destroys all things, seems to be a different being from Vishnu and Brahma, who act by grace, love, preservation of the creature, or for life and creation. It is obvious that such conceptions can be only in a very partial and relative sense true descriptions of the infinite and omnipresent creator and ruler of the universe. Nor does Indian religious thought affirm them as adequate descriptions. The personal God is not limited by his qualities. He is Ananta Guna, capable of infinite qualities, and beyond them, and Lord of them, to use them as he will. And he manifests himself in various names and forms of his infinite Godhead to satisfy the desire and need of the individual soul according to its own nature and personality. It is for this reason that the normal European mind finds it so difficult to understand Indian religion as distinct from Vedantic or Samkhya philosophy, because it cannot easily conceive of a personal God with infinite qualities, a personal God who is not a person, but the sole real person and the source of all personality. Yet that is the only valid and complete truth of the divine personality.
The place of the divine personality in our synthesis will best be considered when we come to speak of the yoga of devotion. It is enough here to indicate that it has its place and keeps it in the integral yoga, and even when liberation has been attained. There are practically three grades of the approach of the personal deity. The first, in which he is conceived as a particular form or particular qualities as a name and form of the Godhead, which our nature and personality prefers, the Ishta Devata. A second, in which he is the one real person, the all personality, the Ananta Guna. A third, in which we get back to the ultimate source of all idea and fact of personality, in that which the Upanishad indicates by the single word he, without fixing any attributes. It is there that our realizations of the personal and impersonal divine meet and become one in the utter Godhead. For the impersonal divine is not ultimately an abstraction or a mere principle or a mere state of or power and degree of being any more than we ourselves are really such abstractions. The intellect first approaches it through such conceptions, but realizations end by exceeding them. Through the realization of higher and higher principles of being and states of consciousness, conscious existence, we arrive not at the annihilation of all in a sort of positive zero, or even in an inexpressible state of existence, but at the transcendent existence itself, which is also the existent who transcends all definition by personality, and yet is always that which is the essence of personality.
Well, we could read that a few more times. When in that we live and have our being, we can possess it in both its modes, the impersonal in a supreme state of being and consciousness, in an infinite impersonality of self-possessing power and bliss, the personal by the divine nature acting through the individual soul form, and by the relation between that and its transcendent and universal self. We may keep even our relation with the personal deity in his forms and names. If, for instance, our work is predominantly a work of love, it is the Lord of love that we can seek to serve and express him. But we shall have at the same time an integral realization of him in all his names and forms and qualities, and not mistake the front of him, which is prominent in our attitude to the world, for all the infinite Godhead. Amen.
Amen.
Chapter reads more like the life divine than some of the other synthesis of yoga chapters.
Yeah. This is more the philosophical, or what we call philosophy. In reality, it's not philosophy. It's a description of his experience expressed in a more philosophical language, if you wish, but it's not philosophy.
So the next chapter about Satchidananda, that should be very interesting. We should get into the heart of things, is my guess.
Yeah, the realization of Satchidananda. Mm-hmm. So this was the modes of the self. Yeah.
I was just wondering if you all notice when you're reading something like this, the words kind of divesting themselves of some of the language and moving into different parts of your being. We talk about it with the intellect, I think. But then there's sometimes a sense of intuition or something, or of light that comes in, maybe of the higher mind or something like that. I was in the last paragraph or two, I was trying to sense whether I could distinguish between those different levels. I couldn't really. I mean, I didn't have a clear sense of it. But he's talking about all these different levels of being, and it might be interesting to try to be aware of them as they flow through the flux.
Yeah.
I was just given a little booklet from Nolini, the five talks by Nolini, and the first talk is about the quality of reading. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you read with the intellect, you'll get some understanding. But if you read with the heart, you get a download. That is not the word he uses, but you get to receive whether your intellect understands it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's really quite beautiful.
Yeah, good point. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we speak always of the intellect, but there is, well, one, as you say, Andrea, is also the psychic being, the heart, the psychic understanding, so to speak, which is not at all an intellectual understanding, but it is yet a way of perceiving the truth. But then there is also, as you said, John Robert, the higher mind, the intuition. And I think these texts here, first and foremost, they address this higher mind, this intuitional way. It begins from the mind, but lures us into the intuitive domains of understanding, which are not supramental, but it is a bit more. It appeals the higher mind, the intuitional mind here. And that's why I don't like to describe Sri Aurobindo as a philosopher, because people, when think as a philosopher, they think someone who tries to, by rational thinking and inferences, to come through logical reasoning and say that the divine is and nirguna and saguna and whatever. But he does not come to this conclusion through a logical thinking. He comes through a direct experience. But even before this direct experience, we can go a bit, I like to call it the higher mind philosophy. And I think this is appealing, the higher mind, more than else. In other parts, it's also the psychic, yeah, the devotion, the devotional part. For example, here we can see when he says the transcendent existence. There's, for example, there's big discussion in them among philosophers. Yeah, what does it mean that something exists? Define existence. So try. You will never find a definition. What does it mean that something exists? Only because you can touch it. Well, it's a sensation. Also in the dream, you can perceive things. Do they exist? Here it says, he gives an answer. It's something that it's not just intellectual. Through the realization of higher and higher principles of being and states of conscious existence, we arrive not at the annihilation of all in a sort of positive zero or even an inexpressible state of existence, but at the transcendent existence itself, which is also the existent who transcends all definition by personality and yet is always that which is the essence of personality. So he says there is only existence. And yeah, okay, it's not just a rational thing. It's something that intuited. And I remember that I was a little child and I tried to understand what does it mean that it exists. And yeah, okay, this is a long story. But I came more or less at the conclusions of Parmenides, who made very similar reasonings. But you can only get there if you think intuitively. If you think it as a rational discourse, you will always find that existence, what does it mean, exist? Do we really exist? Maybe it's all a dream. It's an old philosophical question. And he says, all is transcendent existence. It's the only thing that exists is existence itself. It's when I try to express this, it transforms, it is degraded into a play of words. But for me, it's crystal clear what he means here. Okay, this just as an example how we can exercise our intuition, higher mind way of seeing by reading the texts of Sri Aurobindo. Okay,
shall we have a few minutes?
Yeah. Who is about John Robert?
Such a
Thank
delight.
You, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you again.
Bye-bye.
See you next time. Happy New Year.
Oh, yeah. Happy New Year. You too. Thank you. Bye.